From the Reynolds Journalism Institute at the University of Missouri, welcome to Global Journalist. I'm Jason McClure. The fight against the Islamic State isn't just taking place on the ground or in the skies of Iraq or Libya. It's also on the internet. Earlier this year, the U.S. Defense Department said it was launching a cyber war on ISIS. The military not only wants to disrupt the group's ability to move funds or buy arms, but disrupt its hugely effective use of social media. Indeed, the Islamic State has used apps like Twitter, WhatsApp, and Telegram to recruit new jihadists, instill fear in opponents, and even provoke strangers to launch lone wolf terror attacks in the U.S. and elsewhere. But could it also hack our electrical grid or our checking accounts? On this edition of Global Journalist, a look at the ongoing war against ISIS that's being fought on laptops and smartphones. In a few minutes, we'll talk to a former National Security Agency official, as well as a journalist who has written about a new vulnerability he calls the Ashley Madison Way of War. But joining us first, two journalists who have covered the Islamic State's online presence extensively. From London, Anthony Cuthbertson, a technology reporter for Newsweek. He recently won Digital Writer of the Year from the Online Media Awards. And from New York, Brendan Kerner, a contributing editor for Wired magazine. He recently wrote a feature article detailing ISIS's digital strategy. Welcome to both of you. Brendan Kerner, talk to us about what ISIS has done differently in its media campaign from previous terror groups.
Well, I think a couple of things. First, if you look back and see how much media was part of the DNA of the group dating back to 2004, when it was known as Al-Qaeda in Iraq, and you see Zarqawi, the Jordanian jihadist who was the leader of that group, realized early on that really brutal videos could be very effective at recruiting the kind of soldiers, foot soldiers he needed for his dream of having an Islamic State. Also, I think that as they've grown and they've kind of gained territory, they have decentralized their media operation. They've given each kind of state or province within the caliphate, as they call it, its own media office so they can churn out lots of content. And I think perhaps most importantly, the kind of videos and propaganda they're producing puts the ordinary person at its heart. As you look back, you look what Al-Qaeda was doing with its media. They often had clerics giving sermons or people who were in the elite levels of the organization. The Islamic State has flipped that on its head. It's really put the everyday member of the organization at the heart of its propaganda. I think it's very effective for young people around the world who are used to producing and consuming content that stars themselves very often.
Anthony Cuthbertson, you spend time on apps like Telegram in groups that ISIS members, ISIS supporters have founded. Tell us about the outreach that takes place in these apps, if you will.
That's right. Well, like Brendan was saying, times have changed since Al-Qaeda. There's been the rise of social media, and there's also been the rise of smartphones, which come with apps. So ISIS is able to add this as just another tool in their armory. And apps like Telegram and Wicker and Kick, they all offer methods of both communicating securely amongst members, but also sharing propaganda and instructional videos, and also just as a tool for recruitment. And you would see them on Twitter, you see the cyber caliphate there, but they were being shut down a lot. They've now moved to Telegram, and from there they're moving to other. It's like a hydra. You shut down one and they pop up plenty more where they came from.
And is it difficult for you to find these groups or to join them or to sort of get information from them?
I was personally introduced to them through a group that is monitoring them, a group called the Ghost Security Group, which originally started as a sort of offshoot of Anonymous, but now they've disassociated themselves with them. And they shared some channels, and then once you're in one channel, you have links to new channels, and it's mainly Telegram. I was on there earlier today, and I mean, I was through about a dozen, maybe even 20 channels, and they shut down every day. Telegram has a campaign trying to shut them down, but they just pop up again.
And Brendan Kerner, people sort of, they have this image of ISIS as kind of this savage group. They do post these videos of really horrific atrocities, them blowing up Roman ruins. You've reported that they actually have a fairly sophisticated media strategy document that actually lays out sort of an online marketing plan. They actually view their media war as important or more important than sort of the fight on the ground. Tell us about that.
Yeah, absolutely. So if you go back to a document called The Management of Savagery, it's an ebook by a jihadist cleric who wrote under the pseudonym Abu Bakar Naji that came out in 2004. He really made a point of saying that the West has been so successful in its efforts to subjugate the Muslim world because of its mastery of media, and that jihadists had to study Western media practices and techniques if they wanted to triumph in this clash of civilizations. And so if you look at Islamic State media now, particularly their videos, very few of them are actually these brutal executions and atrocities. Many of them are portraying everyday life in the Islamic State as kind of this blissful, wonderful experience. And they've really borrowed that from Western media. And not only that, but they also narrowcast. They tailor all their videos to specific audiences around the world, both through language and also the customs and aesthetics of these videos. So you may have one video targeted towards Bosnian recruits that's in Bosnian and takes into account Bosnian customary practices, and another targeted towards, say, Filipino communities or communities in the Caribbean. They're very savvy about narrowcasting and tailoring their content to specific audiences around the globe.
And Anthony Cutbertson, you've also been monitoring sort of efforts by the U.S. and other nations to sort of counter these propaganda efforts online by ISIS. The State Department had this sort of roundly mocked campaign called Think Again, Turn Away that was on Twitter, on Tumblr, and other social media. Recently, I understand there's been sort of a new push to have sort of a more sophisticated effort to counter ISIS online on social media. Tell us about that. How do you see, how effective do you see that?
Well, you've also, alongside the government, you've also got to look at the tech companies that actually control these apps and these social media platforms that ISIS is using, Facebook and YouTube through Google. And you've got to see what they're doing to try and stop it. And Twitter, for example, have a big team shutting down accounts that appear to be Islamic State related. I was speaking to a Google executive a couple of months ago, and they said that one thing they were considering was targeted advertisements to aimed at people who search for jihadist content online and put in ads that would say redirect to a message from a cleric saying jihad is not Islamic and the caliphate is not part of what it is to be a Muslim. So that's one method they can use. But really, there's so many platforms now that ISIS is using that it's hard to really stem the flow beyond just shutting temporarily accounts down.
And well, how would you rate sort of the government efforts? Is it, how effective are sort of U.S. State Department Foreign Service officers in countering these propaganda messages that are put out by ISIS?
In terms of countering the message, it's hard really to tell with that. There's no real measure you can make. You said earlier that Ash Carter had announced that they're going to cyber warfare against ISIS. But again, they won't give any details of this because they don't want to give away their game plan, really. You can imagine they'll be maybe targeting infrastructure or listening in on communications. The government isn't going to be telling us exactly what they're going to be doing to try and counter this.
Well, Brendan Koerner, what sorts of messages do you think could be effective in sort of breaking through ISIS's online efforts?
Well, I think the first thing we have to do is analyze Islamic State media and understand what they're afraid of. And if you look back at the fall, there was a coordinated effort among the Islamic State's various media offices to produce propaganda that addressed the refugee issue. The Islamic State is clearly troubled by the outflow of refugees from its territory. Remember, this is an organization that's trying to depict its territory as this kind of paradise on earth. And the fact that people are leaving, fleeing by the hundreds of thousands from that territory, obviously is a huge problem for their narrative of that they're remaining and expanding consistently. And so they came with lots of propaganda about refugees, either coaxing them to come back or excoriating them for fleeing, all sorts of tactics they used. And what they really did is they actually changed the conversation in the West as well. And it became people became afraid of refugees, and it became a situation of, oh, should refugees be allowed to come into the EU or the US? I think we, instead of that, we need to take advantage and give refugees the digital tools and access they need to tell their own stories without interference from the government. That will be authentic, and that will have impact.
And Brendan Koerner, there is this feature of ISIS's online propaganda that actually seems to be intentional, and that is to sort of spur or inspire these lone wolf terror attacks, which aren't centrally planned by someone in Syria or someone in Libya, but are just sort of developed independently by someone in the United States to go out and launch an attack. Tell us about that.
Yeah, clearly the heads of the Islamic State, their media head, has come out and said that, you know, people who all over the world who sympathize with the Islamic State's mission should try to kill people in their home territories if they cannot get to the caliphate. This is a very low investment strategy. Just by putting out words, if someone is unbalanced enough or whatever their personal psychological situation is, wants to lash out, the Islamic State can later claim responsibility and claim that person is kind of a sleeper agent or what have you. So it's a very low investment way for the Islamic State to sow terror in places like the U.S. where they don't really have an on-the-ground operation.
And there's doesn't seem like there's a lot of ways that these types of attacks can be stopped in advance. They seem very difficult.
It's quite difficult, and I think it's not something with a quick fix. In the piece that I wrote for Wired, I talked about the parallels with the problem with hijackings in America in the 60s and 70s, where people who were often psychologically unwell would hijack planes and claim political motives. But if you really scratched beneath the surface, you would find that they had some kind of personal circumstance or grievance that spurred them to do this. We were able to put a stop to that by instituting security at airports, which didn't exist before 1973. Clearly, because Islamic State attacks can take place in any physical space in the U.S., whether it's a building or a shopping mall or what have you, it's much more difficult to address with a sole physical security approach.
And Anthony Cutbertson, we've talked some about sort of this propaganda effort on social media. What do we know about sort of cyber attacks, traditional cyber attacks that ISIS has launched on the West? Do they pose a threat to sort of our online infrastructure?
Currently, no. There haven't been any major attacks carried out by Islamic State hackers. There's a group called the Caliphate Cyber Army, who also recently brought in a non-ghost, and they have carried out some small-scale attacks. There was one example of a laminate flooring company, their website being defaced, also a solar firm in the UK. They also threatened to take down Google and promised to, but actually only ended up taking down a small SEO company in India, which was a bit of an embarrassment.
So wait, why did this cyber caliphate army, why did they launch an attack on a laminate flooring company in the UK? Do we know?
There is, there's no real rhyme or reason. I think just they target sites that have very, very poor security. You imagine a laminate flooring company doesn't really prioritize cybersecurity. They're not worried about hacks. But if ISIS can put a message, an Islamic State's propaganda message on there, then that's a victory for them. And they can use it as proof that they have hacking capabilities, even though it's very low level. I mean, there's even, in fact, groups teaching wannabe hackers how to hack. And they're often very low level targets. Or even just carry out a DDoS attack, which is where you flood a website and it goes offline. But yeah, there was also the Abu Hussein Brittani was probably their most high-profile hacker, but he was killed in an airstrike last year. And since then, the experts I've spoken to about this have said that this has dramatically reduced their cyber capabilities. And currently, they don't pose so much of a threat, but this could obviously very easily change if they manage to recruit some tech-savvy people.
Anthony Cutbertson, Brendan Koerner, thanks so much for joining us. A reminder that this is Global Journalist. I'm Jason McClure. Today, a look at how ISIS is utilizing the internet to spread its message and recruit, and how the U.S. and other countries are trying to fight those efforts. A reminder that if you're interested in more Global Journalist content, visit us online at globaljournalist.org. You can read our ongoing series of interviews with journalists in exile around the world and coverage of foreign affairs and press freedom issues. We're also on social media. You can like us on Facebook or follow us on Twitter. at Global Jern. Let's bring in two experts on cyber terrorism now. From Washington, D.C., Cedric Layton. He's a military analyst for CNN. Before that, he was a colonel in the U.S. Air Force and deputy director for training of the National Security Agency. Also from D.C., Grayson Clary. He's a research associate with the Digital Futures Project at the Wilson Center. His article, The Ashley Madison Way of War, appeared in the Wilson Quarterly this year. Gentlemen, welcome to Global Journalist. Cedric Layton, can you give us just your assessment as to how effective the U.S.'s cyber warfare efforts have been against ISIS?
Sure, Jason. Well, I think they're basically in the ramp-up stage. So what that means is that these efforts are nascent efforts. It's very difficult, I think, for the U.S. to get its and its allies to get it, their heads around the idea that ISIS actually has a cyber capability. And as you mentioned in the previous portion of the show, there are so many things that are going on in terms of recruiting people online and doing things like that, that that's the first part of ISIS's cyber capability. But the second part is one in which they are actively beginning to try to go in and actually conduct what we call computer network attack. In other words, the actual defacing of websites, the actual striking of websites and an IT infrastructure of a targeted entity. So what we're seeing here is the beginnings of ISIS's ability to do that. And then what we have to look at is what is ISIS actually going to be able to do? And the United States is looking at this in a way that is trying to be holistic in its approach. But my belief is that we're just beginning to understand what ISIS's capabilities are and how far we can actually go in order to take them down, or how far we need to go in order to take them down.
And Grayson Clary, you wrote an article warning of sort of one of these nascent attacks. You called it sort of the Ashley Madison attack. Ashley Madison, of course, is the website for people looking to cheat on their significant other that was hacked. Talk to us about what this type of attack entails.
Well, one of the ways that I think ISIS has been especially innovative, and I say that as someone who's fairly skeptical of most talk of cyber terrorism, is in realizing that the malicious disclosure of personal information really can terrify people. If you do look at the Ashley Madison breach, some 20 million accounts and identities were compromised. Obviously, folks were not thrilled for that their families and loved ones were discovering that they had been seeking an affair online. And three of those individuals later committed suicide. So that's more casualties than the median terrorist attack. And ISIS has made a habit out of publishing what it calls kill lists of personal information that belongs to law enforcement officers, U.S. service members, their families, ordinary citizens, etc. Now, to be clear, as far as I'm aware, there haven't been any documented instances in which someone who was doxxed by the Islamic State was later targeted by a lone wolf attack. But I think that's very much a matter of time, because this is very easy. Their hacking abilities are rudimentary. The nice thing about data breaches is that they're not always all that hard to pull off. And in some cases, it seems that they're just collecting personal information open source off the internet. And if they can use it to nudge a lone wolf, someone who's already unhinged, somebody who's already looking to commit violence, to choose a target that's more meaningful to ISIS than to, you know, the average lone wolf, then that's an easy win for them.
And Cedric Layton, tech companies already help with law enforcement. And from the Snowden leaks, we know that telecom companies have also allowed the NSA to gather electronic surveillance. How do you see the relationship between these tech companies and the government evolving in the future?
Well, that's a very interesting question, Jason. And of course, there are two sides to that. On the one hand, you have the issues that come up with the San Bernardino attacks, where Apple and the FBI went at it in court about the famous iPhone and whether or not they can actually go into an iPhone to find data that is specific to that particular device. So on the one hand, there's that issue. On the other hand, there is a cooperative history between telecom companies and the government. And when you look at demands from law enforcement in the wake of the Paris and the Brussels attacks on the European side, we can see similar developments in the U.S. as well. And what that really means is that you're going to have a situation where there's going to be, if there's a major attack, there's going to be a clamor for cooperation between the telco companies and the and other internet service providers and the law enforcement community. In fact, I think in some respects the public is going to demand it. That's basically a pendulum swing from the idea of having, you know, total privacy on the other side of it. So there's a compromise that should be reached there, but I don't think that the legal mechanisms are in place to reach that compromise at present.
And Grace and Clary, there has been talk that the Paris attacks last year, when dozens of people were killed, they could have been prevented, and that there really was sort of a massive failure of intelligence and law enforcement surveillance of ISIS's movements. What do you think made it so difficult to sort of track their communications and planning of this?
Well, the thing I'd say at the outset is not every intelligence failure can be explained by encryption. And I think it's often the temptation of national security officials to say, if we didn't pick up on anything, it must have been because they encrypted their communications. That's not necessarily the case. There are a number of points of failures in the intelligence apparatus. And there are a number of different tactics that terror groups use to conceal their plots until they can actually pull them off. In the Paris case, it seems that the use of burner phones was probably at least as significant, if not more significant.
These are prepaid mobile phones that you can just go out and buy and put money on and use and then throw away when you're done with them, if you will.
Right, exactly. And then the other element is that within a lot of Europe, intelligence sharing is slow if it happens at all. This was a very conspicuous problem in Belgium, which does not have especially effective security institutions. And when you compound the fact that these terrorist networks operate across national borders, let alone across, you know, parochial regional rivalries, it can be exceptionally difficult to get the right information into the right hands, even if someone is under surveillance and even if their communications were collected.
Well, Cedric Layton, you heard Grace and Clary talking about this issue of encryption. How much does it really hinder the government's efforts to collect information on would-be terrorists?
Grayson, I think, has a very valid point here, because encryption is not the end-all and be-all. It is one aspect, and only one aspect, of the intelligence picture. There's a lot, quite frankly, that can be gleaned from what we call the externals of communication, and those are things like the phone number called, the people that are called, the call chaining, if you will, who calls whom, those kinds of things. That's one aspect of what can actually be gleaned from information, even without knowing the keys to an encrypted device. So the actual problem, you know, is really a multifaceted one. And I think a lot of lawmakers and others, and of course the law enforcement officials, have really glommed on to the idea that encryption is the end all and be all. The real problem that we have is there's this huge sea of data that is out there. We talk about big data in the civil discourse about the IT networks and where the internet is going. And big data is also a problem for both law enforcement and the intelligence agencies. Effective data mining techniques are going to be the critical component to any intelligence or law enforcement effort to go after terrorists, to go after ISIS, and to anticipate the kinds of attacks that they could pull off. That's all going to be part of it. And right now, we're only at the beginning stages of really analyzing things in that fashion.
Well, Grace and Clary, we heard Anthony Cuthbertson talking at the top of the show about these Telegram groups that he's in and sort of the rapidity with which ISIS supporters are sort of skipping from one account to the next and moving from one platform to another platform to a different app. So even it seems that if intelligence agencies, if law enforcement were able to sort of see through the encryption on these apps, it would still be very difficult to tell what's a plot and what is just sort of conversation online. What does this sort of say about our overall ability to stop attacks like what happened in San Bernardino or in Paris in the future?
Well, I think they're always going to find ways to communicate faster than we're going to realize they're doing it. One of the revelations that come out of the French investigation into the Paris terror attacks is that they, among other communication methods.
I'm sorry, Grace and Clary, we lost your audio there. Cedric Layton, let me turn it back to you. I was also curious about the role of third parties in sort of this online cyber war. The hacking collective Anonymous has also declared war on ISIS. Where do these sort of vigilante groups, if you will, fit into our picture?
Well, that's something that's a great question, Jason, because Anonymous has, in fact, as you said, declared war on ISIS. And those types of groups like Anonymous are going to have a bit of a challenge going after ISIS because they, generally speaking, don't have the same resources as a state actor like the U.S. government or the British government or other governments would have. However, having said that, there are certain things that they can do that can throw ISIS or any group that they're targeting off balance. So one of the difficulties that the U.S. is going to have with groups like Anonymous is coordinating attacks with them. And I don't think there's any movement that I've detected on the part of U.S. officials or any other allied officials to coordinate attacks against ISIS with Anonymous. And that may be a lost opportunity, frankly, but I don't see Anonymous allying itself with the U.S. government or with any other government to accomplish a task like that.
And Grace and Clary, I'm sorry we lost you just a moment ago. Thanks for sticking with us. I mean, is it the case that given sort of the rapidity with which ISIS can move about and communicate online, that we may just have to tolerate some low level of terror attacks in the future? Or is there a way that we can sort of surveil our way out of this problem?
I think terrorism is always going to be with us. They're always going to find new ways to communicate. There was a brief panic that they had moved to using PlayStation to communicate in Belgium. I've seen the outlandish example that if they really wanted to, they could go into some first-person shooter game, multiplayer online, and actually shoot messages into a wall if they really wanted to communicate securely. There's always going to be an option for them. And there's always going to be unhinged people who want to do violence. And that's why I think we have to resist the temptation to, as you said, surveil our way out of this problem. Because it's just not realistic. If you look at the San Bernardino shooting, that plot was plotted within the bounds of a marriage. I'm not sure I can think of a surveillance regime that would have penetrated that cell, and I'm not sure the American public would want to.
And Cedric Layton, our time does grow short with just about 30 seconds left. I want to ask you about something that Anthony Cuthbertson brought up earlier in the show, and that is the fact that ISIS's technical capacities for launching cyber attacks have been quite small, but they have the potential to grow, particularly if the group stays well-funded. What do you see going forward?
I think one of the big things, Jason, that they're going to be looking for is to affect the critical infrastructure. They've, for example, gone after the Ministry of Defense in the UK, tried to do that. I don't think the attack has been effective at all, but they're probing. They're going after different things, sometimes big name targets. Sometimes they make mistakes, like in the Google case where they hacked the wrong company. So that is what we're going to see. We're going to see perhaps more attempts to do something like that, but I don't think they will be able to muster the strength in the near term to be able to bring down, say, a major utility or a critical infrastructure piece.
That's going to do it for this edition of Global Journalist, a production of the Reynolds Journalism Institute at the University of Missouri. Many thanks to Anthony Cuthbertson, Brendan Kerner, Cedric Layton, and Grayson Clary for joining us. Our executive producer is Joshua Kranzberg, and our supervising producer this week is Javila Ruskoskit, with associate producers Aaron Pelish, Joe Carey, and Yulia Alieva. Our studio director is Travis McMillan of RJI. Our audio engineer is Pat Akers of KBIA. For all of us here at Global Journalist, I'm Jason McClure. Thanks for joining us. We'll see you next week.